Fewer than 1% of Americans are serving or have served in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And this fact, says our guest today, has created a very real and disturbing disconnect between veterans of these wars and the general public. We're talking this hour with Larry Minear. He's author of the new book, Through Veterans' Eyes, The Iraq and Afghanistan Experience. In it, Minear tries to deepen our understanding of what these veterans go through by telling the stories of more than 175 soldiers, including many from New Hampshire and Vermont. And these two small states, he says, have sent relatively large numbers off to war, which is typical of rural states. Although rural America makes up only 17% of the nation's population, it provides 45% of the nation's military. Today in The Exchange, the Afghanistan and Iraq wars, through the experience of New Hampshire and Vermont veterans' eyes, the difficulties they faced, both on the battlefield and the return back home. Let's hear from you, too. Have you or a family member served in either of these wars? How much do you think the public understands what these conflicts mean for members of the military? How hard was the adjustment to life after war? How did multiple deployments affect all those involved? The individual, the family, the community? And do you feel New Hampshire and Vermont do a good job at reintegrating veterans when they come home? Call in 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Larry Minear, it's really nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, in past wars, you know, World War I, World War II, Korea, veterans typically clammed up about their experiences. We all have an uncle or a grandfather or a parent who wouldn't talk about the experience in war. Did you find, Larry, these veterans are a little more open about discussing their experiences?
My general experience in interviewing many of these veterans was that they were quite prepared to talk about their experience. They really had many things that they wanted to share. Sometimes they were a bit reticent in opening a conversation, but I found as I interviewed them that if I listened carefully and gave them assurance that I was sympathetic and that the material they were giving me would not be used for attribution without their consent, they had some very compelling stories to tell.
And were they not only open to telling those stories, but telling how those stories affected them? This happened to me, and it affected me this way.
No, indeed. I found that in many of the conversations, they were prepared to be quite personal in terms of how an experience that they'd had in Ramadi, for example, affected their reentry in rural Vermont. And having seen violence there, how it affected their ability to interact with their families and communities once they were home. So it's quite a rich litany of experiences that I found them really quite willing to share.
You know, that's new, Larry. Then what do you think changed that? Is it sort of modern attitudes towards it's okay for you, especially men, to talk about their feelings, or modern psychology? What do you think changed that?
Well, I think it was in part the encouragement of the military and society as a whole to draw people out, realizing that, for example, Vietnam veterans who had not shared their experiences and bottled them up over the years still carried those things with them. I think there was a more responsive public attitude toward hearing what veterans had to say.
You know, Larry, you've called New England a microcosm of some of the issues that veterans face when they've returned from these wars, Afghanistan and Iraq. What do you mean by that, Larry?
Well, that the people whom I interviewed a couple of hundred only out of a total population of more than 2.25 million who've served in Afghanistan and Iraq. The issues that they raised, the experiences that they had, the interpretations that they gave were consistent with what I then found as I went in a wider circle to other states than New England and drew on other resources. I supplemented my interviews in Vermont and New Hampshire with the Veterans History Project materials in Washington, which is a treasure trove of materials. From Afghanistan and Iraq alone, they have more than 1,000 dossiers. some of them on tape, some of them manuscript, and these were a rich resource in terms of engaging with these issues. So putting this all together, the experiences that people shared in these two New England states rang very true for people nationwide.
Just give us a couple examples of that microcosm that you mentioned.
Let's see, in terms of attitudes toward the violence which they had experienced, there were many people who were not prepared for the carnage in the terms that they were confronted by it. And, for example, people in New Hampshire and Vermont would comment on how it was very hard for them to come to terms with convoys which were going through towns in Iraq or Afghanistan, which under the rules of engagement were not allowed to stop for people in the road because they would then become targets for sniping action. So in proceeding and killing civilians in the process of doing their job, they saw a lot of violence which was hard to come to terms with. When I then looked in the Veterans History Project materials, which cast a much more wide net, that issue of the suffering of civilians was one which rang very true. And in fact, people had difficulty in coming to terms with that and bringing back into their own lives the violence that they'd seen.
Well, and I hope that this hour we'll get lots of stories from New Hampshire and Vermont veterans who are listening, or family members, community members, loved ones. Our number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Join us. We're talking with Larry Minear. His new book is called Through Veterans' Eyes, The Iraq and Afghanistan Experience. Let's hear your experiences. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Larry, what specific places did you find that New Hampshire soldiers went to? Let's talk about them first, and then we'll get to Vermont. Where did they tend to serve?
Well, there were several major deployments from New Hampshire. Some of them went to Kuwait and provided border security in the area of the Iraq border. And they were assigned to the 197th Fires Brigade, which was a convoy support effort that they did. Their experience was generally in accompanying convoys, providing security for convoys, and providing security at the border. They had smaller contingents that were around within Iraq and in Afghanistan as well.
And did you talk to New Hampshire soldiers who were also members of the, if I could call it, the regular military, not just National Guard?
Less so, because in talking to or in reviewing the dossiers of people from the Library of Congress, it's not quite so clear where they're from. Mm-hmm. They at that point have an identification with a given military active duty brigade.
I see. So it's harder to determine where this brigade is from, whereas with the National Guard units, it's New Hampshire National Guard,
That's
Vermont
right.
National Guard. I see. Right. So what about Vermont, Larry? Where did they tend to go and intend to do?
Well, Vermont actually had one of the highest per capita participation rates of any state, and also one of the highest per capita casualty rates.
Really?
So
wow.
They suffered disproportionately as a result of the fact that there were more people from Vermont in these positions than from other states. So they had two major deployments and then a number of minor ones. In 2005, they were providing security on the Kuwait-Iraq border, not doing so much in Iraq, but basically border activities. And then in 2010, they had a large contingent stationed around the Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan, and they were attached there to an Army combat group. The people that I interviewed in small town Vermont around Bradford and Orange County, They had, in the initial deployment, had an armored function, and by the time of the second deployment, they had switched over to an engineering role. But basically, they were seeing some pretty heavy-duty action themselves.
Well, I want to ask you more about those statistics, Larry, but let's take some calls. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And first up is Dan in Epsom. Hi, Dan, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. I was in the Air Force for over 20 years, and at one point I had a unique privilege, you might say. I got to fly out to Saudi Arabia and stayed in a tent city for about 4 months. South of Riyadh. And this was the day I got there, actually, a very little-known operation started called Desert Fox. And that was entirely an air campaign, striking key positions in Iraq and this type of thing. But the thing, I guess, that got me when you're talking about these fellows coming back and then the things they're experiencing over there is one thing that got me is just how unbelievably different that part of the world is to what we have around us here day by day. If so much of it is so absolutely desolate of green, there is a fine dust and powder, you might say, because you're basically walking everywhere on sand or maybe rock, and this dust and powder gets on and into everything. It swirls in the air as the wind starts to pick up, and of course they really can't have some good strong wind there, but the desolation, the lack of available water. We were always having water brought in these bottles, very much like your Poland Spring, you know, in these packages and this type of thing. And of course, they want us to drink this all the time, you know, to avoid dehydration.
Dan, hold on, if you would. I want to ask you a question, but after a break, I want to ask you, you know, what it was like for you coming back home, how hard it was, what was in place to ease that transition. But we have to take a short break, so stay on the line. And if you want to join us, you can call, too, at 1-800-892-6477.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from you, our members, and from Cambridge Trust Company of New Hampshire, building lasting relationships and providing thoughtful, independent investment, trust, and wealth management services. CambridgeTrust.com. And Tarm Biomass and Lime, a leader in alternative heating systems, supplying high-efficiency wood and wood pellet heating for homes and commercial applications. WoodBoilers.com. New Hampshire weather today, windy statewide, mostly cloudy with some breaks of sunshine across most of the state. Cloudy with showers from the White Mountains north. Highs today ranging from 40 north to around 50 in southern parts of the state. Tonight, partly cloudy and windy in most of the state. Cloudy, windy with some snow showers across the White Mountains. Lows tonight from 25 north, 25 to 30 in central parts of the state and around 30 in southern New Hampshire. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny in most of New Hampshire, cloudy, a chance of rain or snow showers from the White Mountains north, highs 42 north, ranging to 52 in southern parts of the state. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Larry Minear discusses his new book, Through Veterans' Eyes, The Iraq and Afghanistan Experience. It includes many stories from New Hampshire and Vermont veterans. We'd like to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email exchange at nhpr.org. And Larry, just before the break, we were on the phone with Dan from Epsom, who served in the Air Force. And Dan, I wanted to ask you what it was like for you coming back after Iraq. I believe that's where you said you served.
Well, it was actually in Saudi Arabia, south of Riyadh. Now, it was wonderful coming back. It was absolutely wonderful. And I was thrilled to see my wife. And my parents, of course, were jubilant. You know, I was home, this type of thing. But I need to say here that even though I was in what you would call a hot conflict, I was never in any danger. You know, I never heard a round fired. I didn't see an explosion. We never even once had to run to our shelters or this type of thing. Whereas these fellows literally coming out of high school are going directly into very hostile environments with people who they don't know, with language they can't speak, with a culture that is so absolutely and radically different from ours that we can't even understand it. So I think when you throw all these things into the mix, seeing them try to come back and you might say vocalize or put it into words what the experience. Oh my goodness. Then, the hostility, the potential death of friends, or the severe wounding of friends, maybe themselves being wounded, or you know, my goodness, seeing people killed, you know, so suddenly too. You know, war happens so fast when you're dealing with automatic weapons or high explosives.
Right, something can happen in an instant. So, just to make sure I got it right, you were based in Saudi Arabia, but you did bombing runs into Iraq. Is that
I was. I was what you would call a support role. We were in a camp that, you know, if Saddam Hussein, I guess, had really wanted to, he might have been able to reach us with a surface-to-air missile, that type of thing.
Okay.
But like I said, no, I really had it in many ways very, very easy. I was just able to observe the world around, and how I was just so glad I never lived there and never will.
Right. Well, Dan, thanks for calling in. And he raises two great points, Larry. One is just culture shock.
Culture shock is almost a universal phenomenon. Despite all the training that was given to military personnel before they went over, everything was so different. A number of them described, for example, having trained in Fort Drum in northern climates and snow, and then within 48 hours arriving and having 130-degree temperature to contend with. In addition to the climate, there were issues of culture, different religion, different customs, different dress. How do you identify civilian population when you don't really understand the culture? So this was a major issue for many soldiers. The other complicating factor was that for security reasons, soldiers were frequently not allowed beyond the wire, so-called. In other words, they were confined to their base. As a result, their interaction with local populations, their chance to get to know people, was very limited. In fact, one of the people that commented on this from New Hampshire said that the best times for him in terms of enjoyment and feeling as though he was contributing was when he snuck off the base in the evenings and met with local tribal elders outside the base, just as a chance of sharing in a person-to-person kind of way.
So that wasn't his job. He snuck off and did that.
Well, he was actually AWOL in doing that, but he was saying this at least gave him a sense of what people were like and established some human contact.
Well, Dan, thanks again for that call. And our number, 1-800-892-6477. If you or a family member served in either of these wars, how much do you think the general public understands what these conflicts mean for members of the U.S. military? Also, tell us how hard the adjustment to life after war was. Maybe it wasn't hard at all. Maybe you struggled. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. The email exchange at nhpr.org. And Larry, I just want to return for a moment with you to those numbers that you gave us before the break, that Vermont especially had a disproportionate amount of its population involved in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Just give us those numbers again, and then I have a question for you.
Right. Vermont had, with a population of about 1 million, had 3,500 slots for the National Guard. New Hampshire, with a population of 1.3 million, had only 2,800 slots. So the chances of being in the Guard in Vermont and being in these wars was greater than had you been in New Hampshire or other states.
And you found out, or maybe I picked this up somewhere else, that rural states make up just 17% of our nation's population, but 45%, almost half of our armed forces. Why is that, Larry?
I think that's in part a reflection of rural unemployment being so crushing. There's obviously unemployment and the lack of job opportunities in urban areas as well, but particularly in rural areas, the attractiveness of signing up for the Guard or enlisting in the active duty armed forces is substantial given the lack of other economic opportunities.
And what's the impact on these states and maybe even more so their communities, these small communities that they come from?
Well, there are some positive impacts in that there's additional pay coming in as a result of hardship duty overseas. And in fact, some of those people have turned their additional money into community benefits. There's a woman in Bradford in the unit there, Cindy Clements, who took her hardship pay and underwrote activities at the local high school where she was a bus driver. So there were benefits there, more money coming in. On the other hand, it is disruptive to have your breadwinners out of the picture and out of action for a year or so, even though they're sending money back.
So many impacts. I mean, the kids in school, the spouse who has to do it all. Right. 35% or more of all the reserve military personnel are employed as civilians in local, state, and federal governments. So police officers, firefighters, corrections officers. So big impacts there.
Absolutely.
Let's take another call, Larry. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. If you are a New Hampshire or Vermont veteran, let's hear your experiences and those of your fellow military members from Northern New England. 1-800-892-6477. Your experiences either on the battlefield or upon returning home. 1-800-892-6477. Let's go to Wolfboro next. Larry, Will is calling from Wolfboro. Hi, Will. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you, Laura. I'm a Vietnam combat vet in amphibious assault forces. And when I came home, it took me over 30 years to talk to anybody about it.
Wow, 30 years, Will.
Yes, even my first wife didn't even know I served. When I came, when I finally started opening up about it, I encouraged people who are listening who are veterans to visit their vet center. In Manchester, these people are combat vets themselves. They understand and they're trained, and it's also a segue. I apologize for the traffic. It's a segue for other services that they recognize you may need. It was a godsend to me. If I may give personal advice to any returning men and women who served over there, it's that you may be better off speaking to veterans. It may sound cold, but that's my experience, that other veterans will understand and they're more likely to listen and be quiet and not give their opinion because they fully understand what they go through and what the transition is going, getting back into civilian life. So I find talking to civilians is very, I just don't do it because they don't get it and they have preconceptions about what it's all about and the glory of war and all that. So
it's too frustrating. You know, I have a question for you, Will, if I could. If you've talked to other veterans, and it sounds like you have, how do you think New Hampshire stands up in terms of providing services for returning veterans compared to other states?
I can't speak to about other states. I didn't seek services until I got back into New Hampshire, but I would say they're excellent. I have no problem with the Veterans Administration and the various services they provide. For my generation, it was Agent Orange, and they have full screening services to tell you whether you've got it or not, PTSD and so forth. I can't speak enough about the services in New Hampshire has offered to me.
And, Will, one more question, if I could, and I appreciate your call. I'm struck by the fact that it took you 30 years to start talking about this. What was the trigger that finally made you say, all right, I have to do this?
God, I don't even know. I do know. When we returned home, it's a whole different picture. We were treated, we were despised, we were treated like criminals. And so many of us found a foxhole, if you will, a virtual foxhole to dive into. And I ran across the person who was one of those people. And I was sitting around a campfire, and he started talking about how he thought the people who ran off to Canada were the brave ones, you know, going against the establishment and all that, and how while they were hiding in Canada, we were out killing civilians in villages in Vietnam. And I snapped. I snapped, and I'm still dealing with it.
Well, Will, it's great to hear from you. I really appreciate your call. Thank you.
I appreciate your show. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. What did you find out through working on this book, Larry, about the services available in New Hampshire? We're used to thinking about New Hampshire as a small government state, not a lot of public services. But according to you, New Hampshire is a model when it comes to providing services to returning veterans.
New Hampshire really does very well in terms of interagency mobilization of not only public resources, but private efforts as well. And I found when I was doing interviews in 2006, 2007, that it was actually setting a fast pace, drawing everybody together around a common table and then coordinating services, employment, education, psychological support, mental health, and the full range. So there was a private-public partnership here that served as a model for other states.
And as I understand, New Hampshire is the only state that has a person within the Department of Health and Human Services specifically assigned to veterans issues. I was surprised by that.
That may well be the case. Others have designated bureaus, but New Hampshire, I think, has set a fast pace in this area.
You know, it was so good to hear from Will in Wolfboro, and I wanted to ask you something, Larry, and see if you heard this from other veterans. He said it took him 30 years to unfold his own story. We talked a little about this before, how the society has changed, the culture has changed. It's okay to talk about your feelings now. I also wonder, though, Larry, if the Vietnam War was so unpopular, and he's right, veterans were treated badly when they returned. This time, they are respected, no matter how someone might feel about the Iraq or Afghanistan war. Does that make a difference in terms of how easy it is for a veteran to open up?
I think it definitely does. Among the people I interviewed were two counselors in the Vet Center in White River Junction who mentioned that as they were working with Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, in those groups they also included Vietnam veterans who were expressing their feelings and reaching out to our current veterans as well. So there's a willingness, I think, among Vietnam veterans now that there's a new set of veterans around to come forward and share their experience.
Wow, that's really interesting. All right, Will, thanks for that one. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. The email exchange at nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Emily's up next from Keene. Hi, Emily. Thanks for calling the exchange. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to comment briefly on the recent comment of why there might be more people in the military from rural areas. And the reason that the speaker gave was that there's less opportunity. And I actually come from a lot of rural areas, Nebraska and South Dakota, and people that I knew that signed up, they signed up for opportunity, but also because they really believed in what they were doing. I think that they had values of serving their country and patriotism and a sense of duty. And I think that those things are really pervasive in rural areas that maybe urban areas don't have that necessarily.
So there's a cultural reason why people sign up, too. A value system, Emily.
I think so.
So it's been said that rural areas sometimes have a harder time helping veterans who are returning because they typically don't have as many resources as a big city. What have you seen, Emily?
Well, I think that there's a lot of feeling of community and neighborhood. And so, you know, I know men that came back and really relied on their community to get them through. Although I don't know men who came back who were injured and maybe needed more services that were specialized.
What did you find out about that, Larry? Stay with us, Emily, if you could, about the ability of these small communities to help the people who came home out.
Mm-hmm. I found that actually small communities were very creative in mobilizing resources.
Really?
Partly because everybody knows everybody.
Right.
In the town of Bradford, for example, the father and son in a given family were in the same National Guard unit away at the same time. And so people rallied around to help their next of kin who were still trying to make ends meet and do the necessaries in their home situation. I think rural areas generally have a better knowledge of people and families and community issues and therefore pull together admirably in a situation like this.
Even though they might not have the traditional resources of a larger city, they've got those sort of strong ties. Everyone knows each other. Everybody helps each other out.
Right. And in fact, in Bradford, there was a support group that was formed during the initial deployment in 2004, 2005, so that the spouses and mothers and fathers of people who were away could meet, identify their needs, and then the community would respond. So a very positive grassroots effort, which is even strengthened in the later deployments.
And yet one complaint that we hear here in New Hampshire is that because we're still largely a rural state, we're the only state without a full-scale veterans hospital. Have you heard about that, Larry, through the New Hampshire veterans that you talked to?
I didn't hear that through the veterans, but I know the Boston Globe fairly recently did a story about how people from New Hampshire had to go either to White River Junction or to the Boston area at personal expense and inconvenience in order to get the needs met. One of the things I commented on in the book is that in the years after the Vietnam War, there had been a consolidation and a centralization of services for veterans as a cost containment measure. As a result, now that we come to a new generation of veterans, there are fewer services available and they're less conveniently located. So again, rural people have more difficulties than urban.
Well, and on that line, we talked earlier with Will, who encouraged people to go to the vet center, to talk to other vets. If you live, you know, way out in some tiny town, you may not have one close to you. You may have to drive 30 or 40 miles to get to one. So that's another challenge.
Not only that, but the private practitioners who provide services in mental health in rural areas are not as familiar with PTSD or traumatic brain injuries, not having seen as many people who have suffered from them. So the quality of services may also be more limited.
All right. Well, Emily, thanks for that call. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we talk to author Larry Minear. His new book is called Through Veterans' Eyes. How would you rate the efforts of New Hampshire and Vermont in terms of reintegrating veterans when they return home? If you or a family member has served in either Afghanistan or Iraq, how much do you think other people not connected with the military understand what these conflicts mean for our members of the Armed Services? Our number 1-800-892-6477, and we'll be right back.
The Tupelo Public Radio Project brings nationally renowned musicians to a New England stage. I'm Kate McNally. Join me for the first of this live concert series featuring the talents of Katie Curtis.
If I make a mark in time, I can't say the mark is mine. I'm only the underline.
Catch Katie Curtis live on stage at the Tupelo Music Hall in White River Junction, Vermont. The fun starts at 8 on November 11th. Get your tickets at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Waste Management. In 2009, Waste Management recycled enough waste to fill the Empire State Building 12.5 times. Information on how this is done at thinkgreen.com. And from Collins Dentistry for Children, treating the dental needs of infants through teens in southern New Hampshire with locations in Nashua and Pelham. Details at collinsdentistry.com. Coming up at 10 o'clock, the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show. New Hampshire weather today, mostly cloudy, some breaks of sunshine across most of the state. Cloudy with showers from the White Mountains north. Windy statewide today, high temperatures ranging from 40 in the north country to about 50 in southern parts of the state. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the experiences of New Hampshire and Vermont veterans, from the battlefront to back home. It's all in a new book by Larry Minear called Through Veterans' Eyes, The Iraq and Afghanistan Experience. Let's hear your stories and experiences. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Larry, before we return to our callers, I did want to follow up on something else Emily said. She took issue a little bit with what you said about sometimes people in small towns sign up for the military because they have less economic opportunity than people in large areas. She also said she feels like rural values, small town values are behind this high registration rate we see from people from these areas.
Right. There was a continuing theme in a lot of the interviews about the patriotic response of veterans to signing up and to service. What interested me in part, though, was that Many of them did not sign up as a result of 9/11 specifically to participate in the global war on terror. They signed up because it was their duty to do so. Having served in the military, many people who then returned did have a strengthened sense of the importance of community and family. In the focus group that we had in the Bradford Armory, for example, one of the mothers there said that a positive result of her son's service was that he became more interested in civic activities, in family history, participated more in parades and holiday celebrations. So there is a sense that that the patriotic impulses did promote people's involvement, and that some of those were strengthened as a result of their service overseas.
Let's take another call, Larry. This is Pete in Hanover. Hi, Pete. You're on the air. Thanks for calling The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. It's a pleasure to join you all, and I really appreciate the focus of this show. I'm a regular Army veteran, served about 27 and a half years in the Army. I've served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Originally from New London, now actually live in Goshen. I think the previous caller beat me to the punch regarding motivations.
Let's hear it, Pete. Yeah, go ahead.
A lot of rural Americans and why they joined the military. I would echo the previous caller's assertion that a sense of patriotism and civic duty motivate a sizable number of rural Americans to join. And I can draw a contrast between, the ethos that kind of pervades New Hampshire's small towns versus a lot of the larger metropolitan areas that I've lived. Contrasting Washington, D.C., where school kids don't even get Veterans Day off in the public schools, and here in New Hampshire, where Veterans Day, Memorial Day, and other national holidays are really, respected and honored, and there's a lot of community participation in the celebration.
Pete, could I ask you a question or two? Since you served in these two wars, and those are the wars that Larry Minear's book focuses on, first off, what did you go through when you came back? What was the hardest thing about reintegrating yourself into your home society?
Well, I guess I was struck when I came back at how frivolous and materialistic a lot of general life in America seemed, in contrast to the priorities that one lived every day downrange, and that took some adjustment. I do think that people were welcoming when they became aware of mine and others' service, and that certainly helped. Just personally coming back, having been away from family, there was, some adjustment there, but that went pretty smoothly.
Absolutely. You've been gone, and they've developed their own way of doing things,
right,
haven't they?
Right.
Without you.
Right.
How well do you think, Pete, New Hampshire has done in terms of reintegrating veterans such as yourself back into regular life?
Well, again, my experience may be a departure from the norm with a lot of New Hampshire vets, in that I deployed as a member of the regular Army and returned, to my home base, which wasn't in New Hampshire. But I know when I last came out of deployment to Afghanistan in 2007, and I retired back home to New Hampshire in late 2008. And I know New Hampshire was very welcoming. I got, formal correspondence from, the state recognizing my service and making me aware of the various services available to, to veterans, which I, certainly appreciated. I haven't had to avail myself of those services much. I have relied on the, the VA for some medical care. But I would say, in my own personal experience, I thought that was very aware, and they were very forthcoming and wanted to make sure that I understood what services were available to me, which I greatly appreciated.
Well, Pete, it's good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank
you
very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, one more question on this, Larry, about New Hampshire's efforts as a model for reintegrating veterans. As I understand, a couple years back, the National Guard here did a study of returning members of its forces and started changing the way that they did these returns.
Initially, the idea was to have a mass debriefing as people came back, simply wishing people well, sending them off to their civilian duties after their military service. However, in 2005, I believe it was, in one of the early contingents coming back, one of the soldiers took his own life on his first day back.
Wow.
And this was a warning shot, if you will, to the leadership in Concord. And they basically said, we should be concerned not so much about the bunting that we're going to display in the gym to provide the context for the welcome, but we should find out more about what these people have experienced. So what they did then was to move to a system of one-on-one debriefings. Everyone, before they went back to civilian life, had a session with some kind of a screener. And they found there that more than half of the 800 people in this initial contingent needed some kind of support services, be it employment or psychological or whatever. And this then became a model for other states to move away from sort of a general dismissal of the returning troops and proceed that with a one-on-one debriefing.
Well, real interesting. And as I understand, in some cases, they delay the reunification of families because they need time.
Absolutely. In fact, the commanding officers wanted to get the families and the returnees together as soon as possible, as did the soldiers themselves.
Sure.
But basically, the leadership said, no, we've got to look at people before we send them out and see what they're going to need down the line.
And as I understand, it's being copied by a couple other states, yes, so indeed. It's real interesting. All right, let's go to Chester, and Marie's on the air. Hi, Marie. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Morning.
I work at the shipyard. I work with the active duty, and we also have a very active retiree segment there. And as a civilian, I feel like other civilians don't have a clue of what our military go through or have gone through. It is very, very difficult for them and their families. There are a great number of challenges. They give up an awful lot for what they do. And unfortunately, I'm a New Hampshire native. I've lived here all my life. And until I started working with them, didn't have a clue of how difficult military life is.
And Marie, why do you think it's important for non-military people to have a clue?
How stressful it is on their families. I'll give you an example. One of our military was at our base, and they were told they were going to Groton. So he sent his family ahead of Groton to Groton, built a house, started putting his kids in school, da-da-da-da-da. Orders changed, and he went off to Guam.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so, you know, it might be, okay, wife, you know, sell the house, you know, sell the cars, get visas, get everything for the kids. It's very difficult and very stressful on them, or worried about their spouse that's in deployment and not knowing all the time where they are or if they can communicate with them. You know, and one of our military officers said to me, you know, it's really easy to say, okay, so the husband's gone and we'll gather around. But as soon as the person goes, the washer breaks, the kids act up in school, you know, the car breaks down, and there's one spouse left there to deal with everything.
I've heard my washing machine and my car waited for my spouse to leave before breaking down.
It's so tough for them.
Well, Marie, thanks a lot for calling. And, you know, Larry, this is part of the reason why you wrote the book, What Marie Says. It's
Absolutely.
Important for us to have a clue.
The experiences are so important, and yet the public often doesn't reach out and encourage veterans to share. There was one example I quoted of a New Hampshire National Guard person, Mike Moriarty, who returned to a ceremony at his company in which they set up a welcome home party, and he brought his pictures along to show them of his experience in Iraq. And he found that they weren't interested in seeing his pictures, weren't really interested in knowing what he'd been through, and got really aggravated and turned the party into a less than welcoming situation.
That's why, then, it's important, as Marie says, to get a clue.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's such a an experience that has been accumulated and has changed the veterans themselves that we, I think, as the public need to be aware of that and to deal with it.
Now, the gentleman you just named, Mike Moriarty, was he the New Hampshire soldier who did the War Tapes project with Zach Bozzi and Stephen
Pink?
Pink, right. Right.
Yes, he was one of three who filmed his experiences and commented on it. And he was one who whose reentry was very difficult as a result of what he'd experienced overseas. In fact, all three of those vets became more troubled by the wars and had difficulties reentering as a result of some of their experiences.
Yeah, and we did a program on the War Tapes and talked with, I remember Zach Bozzi, for sure, we talked
Indeed.
To him. And that made a big splash here in New Hampshire when it came out years back.
Actually, this is one of the areas in which I think New Hampshire has done some exemplary things. The National Guard here has been very open to giving veterans like the trio that you mentioned a chance to record their experiences. They've been open to having newspaper reporters talk to their personnel. And myself as a researcher, they were very accommodating and open in sharing their experience.
You know, we talked about efforts in New Hampshire by the Guard here, by communities, by the government. Another effort that I've been struck by, Larry, and that you mentioned in the book is New Hampshire and Vermont colleges. Some have made serious outreach efforts to help veterans get that college degree.
Yes, there are a number of veterans opportunities. There's nationally a new veterans bill that allows for college tuition to be underwritten. And there's been quite an effort here locally to place people in those in nearby colleges. Also, I mentioned in the book that Dartmouth College has established a particular opening for people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and has found it valuable not only for those people but for the other students in the student body.
Right. The president of Dartmouth said, you know, if you're talking about war and you've got a couple students who've actually seen what happens when an IED goes off, that's important for the other students to know. Let's take one more, Larry, if we could. Sebastian's calling from Greenfield. Hi, Sebastian. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I'm interested in the I think this project Larry is doing is fantastic. And I teach storytelling every semester at New Hampshire Institute of Art. And with those students, I'm constantly asking them to tell stories about Iraq and Afghanistan, saying, you know, this is the story of your life. This is the story you will tell. And last semester, I had one student, a female student, told her cousin's story when he returned from Iraq and put on his uniform and told his story. And he kept saying to her, you know, this isn't that interesting. And she kept saying, no, it's really interesting. And when she told his story dressed in his uniform, you could hear a pin drop. And so I think that storytelling is a great way of being able to get high school students and our college students to really engage with the story that's going to be the story of their life. So I'm thrilled that Larry's got that material. And I love what he was talking about, the Veterans History Project. And I think that sounds like a great resource for people who want to engage with storytelling like that.
What age do you teach, Sebastian? High school?
No, college. New Hampshire Institute of Art.
Okay. All right, great. Thanks for calling, Sebastian. I'm sure that's ringing true for you, Larry. Yeah,
absolutely. In fact, oral history is a fascinating point of entry into the events that are being described. One of the nice aspects of the Veterans History Project is that many of the dossiers that are there are digitized so that you can, in the privacy of your studio or your study or whatever, you can go to the internet and access the files, watch the interviews, and engage in the process from your own vantage point. So there's a lot of good resources out there.
Who's your intended audience with this book, Larry? Is it veterans and their families, or is it that other 99% we talked about earlier who have no direct contact or connection with these wars?
Well, the hope as far as veterans is concerned is to encourage them to tell their stories. And so I tried to incorporate as much from them, from their own oral history as possible. I also put in a dozen pictures, photographs that they themselves had taken, and each one of them is explained in terms of why this photograph is important to them. But the audience beyond that is indeed the general public, which I think is in need of tapping into this experience and opening itself up more to what they've experienced.
So convince someone listening now who has no direct connection, you know, who says, well, that's great, but I'm real busy. Convince that person to sit down, take the time to read this book. Again, the person with no connection.
Well, this is, I think if you open the book and follow some of these veterans through the process of enlistment, training, exposure to combat, reentry, the whole arc, the trajectory of the experience, it's a wonderful learning, and it will resonate with a lot that they themselves have experienced.
Well, Larry, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you very much for making the trip from Vermont to come in today. I appreciate
it. Thank you, indeed.
That's Larry Minear, author of the book Through Veterans' Eyes, The Iraq and Afghanistan Experience. Larry Minear has researched armed conflicts for the past 20 years, served as director of the Humanitarianism and War Project at both Brown and Tufts Universities. He's worked on several studies and many books. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Charlotte Evans. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.